Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A Kenyan court suspends part of a new security law. The family of a jailed journalist hopes he will be deported from Egypt. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Kenya's high court has suspended key parts of a new national security law pending a full examination by the legislation. A high court judge, George Odunga, today said the new anti-terrorism law raises concerns about the violation of human rights. After signing the legislation, President Uhuru Kenyatta said the law gives the country some of the tools it needs to fight terrorism. It increases the time suspects can be held without charge and imposes strict rules on how the media report on security issues. Critics are saying the measures threaten civil liberties and free speech. Somali authorities say six people were killed and dozens were wounded when al-Shabaab militants attacked a military base on the outskirts of the town of Baidoa. Witnesses say gunmen today attacked a checkpoint manned by Somali soldiers. The casualties included combatants from both sides. Also today, a Somali security guard was killed and four other people wounded when a vehicle exploded in the central town of Galkayo. Two Kenyan school teachers were reported to be among the wounded. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. The AFP news service quotes Gambian intelligence sources as saying several dozen military personnel have been arrested in connection with a reported coup attempt earlier in the week. They also say a cache of weapons and explosives has been found. President Yahya Jammeh was out of the country Tuesday when the attack was launched on the presidential palace. This is VOA News. The government of South Sudan says it will hold elections in 2015, despite the civil war there. The AFP News Service says the country's president is promising to give rebel figures amnesty. The family of an Australian journalist imprisoned in Egypt says his lawyers have applied to have him deported. The deportation move follows a decision by an Egyptian court Thursday ordering the retrial of the Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresta and his two colleagues, Canadian-Egyptian Mohamed Fahmy and Egyptian Bahir Mohamed. The brothers of Gresta said today in Australia that they have pinned their hopes for their brother's return on a recent decree by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, giving him the power to deport foreign crime suspects.
We are encouraged by this development, particularly in light of recent comments from President al-Sisi over the past few months wishing that the journalists had been deported.
Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop confirmed the deportation route for Gresta is being pursued. The president of Niger says the crisis in neighboring Libya will not end without international intervention. According to an AFP report, President Mamadou Issoufou said today the militias cannot create conditions for reconciliation among Libyans. At a summit in Mauritania last month, leaders in the sub-Saharan Sahel region of Africa called on the UN to organize an international force to neutralize the armed groups in Libya. Libya has collapsed into chaos with warring militias and rival governments. Reuters reports that Panzi Hospital in the Congolese city of Bukavu has had its bank accounts frozen due to allegations of tax fraud. The hospital specializes in treating the victims of rape during wars. The hospital head, Dr. Dennis Mukwege, says the facility is being unfairly targeted by DRC officials because of his criticism of the government's failure to bring rapists to justice. This from the Associated Press. A Ugandan opposition group says a general who recently returned to the country from exile abroad has been placed under house arrest. Free Uganda said today that four-star general David Sejusa was arrested on orders from President Yoweri Museveni. The general heads a political party critical of what it says is Mr. Museveni's authoritarian rule. Sejusa told reporters Thursday he was turning down an invitation from the president for a reconciliation meeting. A spokesman for the military said General Sejusa is being detained for his protection. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's High Court has suspended some of the more controversial measures of a national security law following a challenge from opposition lawmakers and a rights group. The ruling Friday affects restrictions on the media and refugees, as well as new powers granted to the police.
That's correspondent VOA Gabe Joslow reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Al-Shabaab militants attack a military base on the outskirts of the town of Baidoa, killing at least six Somali soldiers. And Gambian security forces begin house-to-house searches in the capital after a failed attempt to get rid of President Yahya Jammeh.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the West Africa Ebola outbreak began just over a year ago in Guinea, but health officials still cannot say when it will be contained. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says while progress has been made, much more needs to be done to prevent a relapse. More than 20,000 cases have been reported and nearly 8,000 deaths. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Red Cross's Catherine Mueller gives an assessment of the Ebola epidemic in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
The Ebola outbreak is not under control yet. We do see some leveling off of cases for Liberia, for example. However, we've seen it before that somebody attends a funeral, they come back, they're infected, they infect their village, and cases spike. So it really doesn't take much to have another increase in cases.
Mueller is the IFRC's Africa Communications Manager. She worries that people may become complacent after hearing that the number of new cases has slowed in some places.
That's actually one of the things that we're concerned about, is once people in the country start seeing this leveling off of cases, that they're figuring, yay, we're beating this thing, and it's too early to say that. This is the new normal of living with Ebola, that it's just not going to go away.
Part of the organization's efforts include going to remote areas in the three hardest-hit countries.
So far, our volunteers have reached almost 3.5 million people with their messages about how to protect themselves and how to stop the spread. We're having some success, but we're also finding that still a lot of those messages are not being heard. So we really need to figure out how to talk to these communities in a way that they'll understand and actually implement the messaging. Talking with the religious leaders, the community leaders, people who are really well-respected, traditional healers, and getting the messages shared by them.
Mueller says some of the major obstacles to raising awareness are fear and mistrust, both of the governments and some Westerners.
A lot of them had never seen white people before. So white people came in when Ebola came in, and communities are connecting the two, and in a lot of cases are blaming the Western aid workers who are there for bringing Ebola into their communities. So those are some of the challenges that we're up against.
And there are logistical challenges.
We definitely do not have enough beds to be able to support all the people who would need them. What we're also noticing, though, is that there's this geographical spread of the virus. So we go in and we set up a treatment center in Kenema, Sierra Leone, for example, and then the virus has spread to other remote communities. And that actually makes it harder to manage, because if we move the resources from one area to another, cases start spiking in that original area.
The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is asking its partners to expand their operations in the rural areas. Mueller says amid the crisis, there are success stories.
People are surviving this disease. At our treatment center in Kenema in Sierra Leone, we've had more than 200 people discharged from the treatment center. Now, not all of them have been confirmed Ebola patients, but a good majority have been. We've also had local nurses who have survived, and they're now actually coming back and joining the Red Cross, and they're volunteering at the treatment center to look after the children who can't be together with their parents who are also at the center.
The main goal is to reach zero Ebola cases in West Africa. However, she says, it's important to start talking about investing in African health systems, training medical personnel, and greatly improving access to health care. The IFRC has called a meeting for the end of January to begin planning long-term operations in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma has asked his countrymen to begin a week of fasting and prayer to end the Ebola epidemic. The outbreak has killed more than 2,700 people in Sierra Leone. The fasting began Thursday night. Bai Koroma also says schools will reopen but cautioned people to obey quarantines and not to touch those who are sick or who have died of Ebola. An Italian doctor who worked in Sierra Leone is reported to have recovered from the virus in a Rome hospital. He was Italy's first Ebola patient. Medical experts are divided over whether most Ebola patients in West Africa should be given intravenous hydration, a therapy that is standard in developing countries. Some argue that more aggressive treatment with IV fluids is medically possible and a moral obligation. Others say more aggressive tactics could put health workers at greater risk and could even kill patients.
Eleven minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Somali authorities say al-Shabaab militants have attacked a military base on the outskirts of the town of Baidoa, killing at least six Somali soldiers. Authorities say the attack left at least 18 people wounded. Earlier this week, the United States confirmed that al-Shabaab's intelligence and security chief, Talil Abdul Shakir, died Monday in a U.S. strike on a vehicle in the Somali town of Sakow. The Pentagon said the death of Talil, who was responsible for al-Shabaab's external operations, will have a significant impact on al-Shabaab's ability to conduct attacks against the Somali government, the Somali people, and U.S. allies and interests. A Pentagon spokesman says it is believed the raid caused no civilian casualties.
Kenya's High Court has suspended some of the more controversial measures of a national security law following a challenge from opposition lawmakers and a rights group. VOA's Gabe Jatlow reports the ruling today affects restrictions on the media and refugees, as well as new powers granted to the police.
High Court Judge George Odunga suspended eight clauses in Kenya's Security Law Act pending a further hearing. Among the clauses was a provision that granted the police the right to detain suspects without charge for 360 days, a measure imposing harsh fines on media outlets that broadcast images deemed offensive by the state, and another clause that put a limit on the number of refugees allowed in the country. Opposition lawmakers and the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights brought the challenge against the law to the High Court. KNCHR Commissioner Suzanne Shatika Chivusia told VOA some of the provisions were oppressive and in violation of the Constitution, noting the restrictions on refugees.
The import of that is that some would have to be taken back to places where their life could be under danger. I don't know how implementation of that law would have occurred, because either way it would have violated the rights of a genuine refugee.
Kenya already hosts more than 500,000 refugees, mostly from Somalia. The new law would limit the total number to 150,000. The initial bill was passed in mid-December during a chaotic session of parliament in which lawmakers threw punches and tossed papers on the floor of the National Assembly. Chivusia says the law was approved without enough public input or time for lawmakers to debate.
If we are going to allow flawed processes to result into enactment of the legislation, that is going to be a very dangerous precedent.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who signed the law shortly after it was passed, has denied it violates the Constitution and has said all the amendments are in the interest of national security. The ruling Jubilee Coalition pushed for the new security laws to combat the rising threat of terrorism in Kenya following attacks claimed by or attributed to the Somali militant group al-Shabaab. In the worst attack, al-Shabaab fighters assaulted Nairobi's Westgate shopping mall in September 2013 and killed more than 60 people. Gabe Josselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Yeah. Gambian security forces have begun a house-to-house search in the capital after a failed attempt to get rid of President Yahya Jammeh. Mr. Jammeh weighed on national television Wednesday night to deny that the hours-long assault on the palace in Banjul on Tuesday was a military coup. He said the military was loyal and blamed the fighting on terrorists with support from dissident Gambians living in Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The president was on a personal visit to Dubai when the palace attacks occurred. On his return, he was shown the bodies of several suspects. A military officer said troops had killed five suspects, including an army deserter. There are unconfirmed reports that one of the dead is a former head of the Presidential Guard, Lieutenant Colonel Lamine Sané. There are reports that members of Sané's family have been detained. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged calm in the country and called for an even-handed investigation of the incident. The United States, which recently expelled the Gambia from a trade treaty after accusing the president of human rights abuses, denied any involvement in the coup attempt.
Human traffickers are using a new tactic to combat a change in Italy's approach to dealing with asylum seekers. They are leaving refugees, mainly from Syria, abandoned on ships steaming towards shore. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
For the second time in a week, authorities in Italy are rescuing illegal migrants from a ship near its coast. This time, the ship carries about 450 people, believed to be mostly from Syria. On Wednesday, twice as many, also believed to be mostly Syrians, had to be rescued from a ship near another Italian port. In both cases, all the crew members had fled, leaving the ships on autopilot heading toward shore. That forced the Italian Coast Guard to rescue the passengers and bring them into port. The traffickers' new tactic appears to be a response to Italy's decision to end Operation Mare Nostrum, which had more patrol boats farther out at sea. Traffickers would put the migrants in small boats or life rafts, and the patrols would rescue them. Professor Emeritus John Salt of University College London says by withdrawing the patrols, the Italians appear to be sending a message that so far migrants and traffickers are ignoring.
By withdrawing, as they have done from the Mare Nostrum operation, they're sending the message that you aren't going to be rescued, so don't come. That is a longer-term solution because there are already quite clearly people in the pipeline who are going to come anyway. I think it remains to be seen whether in the longer run the new policy will deter or not.
Italy now relies on a European Union agency called Frontex, which has far fewer resources for responding to the flow of asylum seekers and fewer patrol boats. Traffickers who charge high prices to transport illegal migrants to Europe appear to have adapted by steering their ships toward shore, putting them on autopilot and then abandoning them. In the process, they lose their ships, but Professor Salt says the vessels are old and have little value.
I think this new tactic has taken everybody by surprise. Don't forget, these things are always businesses. I don't think we really understand how this business works.
What seems clear is that the trafficking business is exploiting a new market among Syrian refugees in Turkey and using a new tactic to get them into Europe. And Professor Salt says that's putting more pressure on southern European countries, mainly Italy and Greece, already burdened by the flow of African asylum seekers and continuing hard economic times. And as in past refugee crises, he says their allies farther north are likely to offer little more than sympathy. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
19 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In Egypt, three Al Jazeera journalists who will be given a new trial on charges of spreading false information and aiding members of the banned Muslim Brotherhood will likely spend another 45 days in jail. A Cairo court Tuesday granted an appeal of their guilty verdicts, but decided they will remain in jail until a new trial next month.
Peter Gresty, Mohamed Fahmy, and Barar Mohamed were sentenced June 10th to 7 to 10 years in prison on the original charges. Gristi's family has requested that President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi deport the Australian journalist. Fahmi's wife made a similar appeal for her husband, who has Canadian citizenship. The president earlier decreed that he can expel foreigners sentenced or now serving in prison. The acting director of Al Jazeera, Mustafa Suwag, says the three were unjustly imprisoned for political purposes.
The international NGO Light for the World takes a look back at 2014 as a successful year, working on behalf of tens of thousands of poor people around the world. Along with partners and donors, the NGO has been able to save and restore eyesight, give children with disabilities access to education, and build a new eye clinic that will provide 2 million people with eye care. Gabriella Sonleitner is Director of Communications for Light for the World. She spoke with me about some of the challenges that were overcome last year and what lies ahead for 2015.
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is always to keep our work ongoing. So our goal was to do 50,000 cataract operations in all our focus countries, for example, in Ethiopia, Mozambique, Burkina Faso, but also in Northeast India and Pakistan. And I think we have succeeded. We have reached 50,000. That means 50,000 people can see again. And I think we are very happy that we could kind of reach this goal. Overmore, we started to build a clinic in Mozambique, which is great to be able to do this. And this clinic is focusing on education, so we will be able to educate medical staff, experts on eye care in Beira, and I hope we will be finishing the building by the end of the year. And moreover, one big project in Burkina Faso for children with disabilities. We started to build a project for inclusive education. We want to bring disabled people to school, and we focus on a district with 300,000 people. And we succeeded in having 55 schools being able to take on children with disabilities. And I think this is a great success for us.
Also, I know that mapping was a very big part of the work that you all did in 2014. Yeah. So how important is that in fighting trachoma?
Very important. We finished our trachoma mapping in Ethiopia, in the Tigray region, and we know now exactly the action plan, what needs to be done in the next 3 to 5 years, in which villages we have to do the mass drug administration, how many people are waiting for the trachoma operation. So now we have the exact figures, and we have already succeeded to get the funds for certain districts, so we are on a good path in Ethiopia. In Mozambique, we finished the trachoma mapping in the Tete region, and there the trachoma is not as dangerous as we thought it would be, so we are a bit released in the Tete region, and in Sofala we started the mapping, and we're still waiting for the results.
I know one of the big emphasis that I saw when I was there in Ethiopia with you all was the emphasis on the safe strategy in preventing trachoma. So how has this been embraced by people?
We started to implement the safe strategy in Tigray region. We did the first pilot project in autumn, and we saw that this is work, that the people there are really willing to join in, to spread the message, to come to the mass drug administrations, to go to the operations, to improve their hygiene. So it was a big success there, that the people really included in their daily work, that the health authorities included in their health programs. And I think a big success is that also the government has agreed to give some funds for the operations. So I think the safe strategy is agreed by all players in Ethiopia, in the Tigray region. I think we now will be successful in the next 3 to 5 years. And I think we will be successful to get some more funds to really bring the work down to earth.
What are some of the biggest goals for 2015?
In Ethiopia, it's to really bring the safe strategy in the Tigray region up and running. I think the first 16 districts. We have now finished the financing, and now we are looking for the next district to get the financing for this region. The second thing is in Mozambique to finish our eye clinic. And then, as I said in the beginning, it's important to keep on going with the cataract operations. This is still the main cause for blindness in Ethiopia, in Mozambique, and Beira, our focus countries. And still, if we are investing in other areas like trachoma, we need to keep on going in this area.
That was Gabriela Sonnleitner, Director of Communications for Light for the World. She spoke with me from Vienna, Austria.
And in news from Asia, search and rescue crews from at least five nations are now involved in the search for the Air Asia flight that crashed into the Java Sea Sunday. A key goal is retrieving the jet's data and voice recorders. So far, the bodies of 30 of the 162 people aboard the airbase jet have been recovered. The Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
Search teams and vessels from Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Japan, and the United States are helping to intensify the search Friday for the wreckage of Air Asia Flight 8501 that crashed in heavy weather Sunday. Technical teams using metal detectors are scanning the Java Sea at a time when there has been some easing of the challenging weather conditions of recent days. The experts include those from the French company BEA, the manufacturer of the Airbus A300 that went down with 162 passengers and crew on board halfway through a routine flight from the Indonesian city of Surabaya to Singapore. BEA said in a statement hydrophones would be used in a bid to locate the acoustic beacons of the flight recorders, which have a signal range up to 3,000 metres. On Friday, at least six bodies were located by helicopters from the USS Sampson, a Navy destroyer involved in the search effort. Indonesian media reported Friday how the bodies were being transported back to Surabaya for formal identification after initially being taken to Panggalabun and in Kalimantan, the town nearest to the site of the crash. Hugh Ritchie, a chief executive of the Sydney-based Aviation Consultants International, says search teams hope the aircraft is still largely in one piece after crashing into the sea.
Still leads to the common belief that it broke up on impact rather than in the air, and that's why we've got bodies in such close proximity.
More than 145 people are still missing from the flight, with families in Surabaya preparing for the task of formal identification. On Thursday, the body of the first victim formally identified, a woman from Surabaya, was returned to her family. Late in the day, her coffin was buried as 150 people looked on in drizzling rain. Officials says the weather outlook remains a challenge for search teams, with rain and strong winds and waves up to 4 metres predicted through to Sunday, while strong sea currents keep debris moving. Analysts say once the flight recorders are recovered from the Air Asia 8501 flight, analysis of the data is expected to lead to an interim report within weeks as to the cause of the accident. But a final, more detailed report may take a year. The Air Asia tragedy follows the loss of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 in March with 239 passengers and crew on board. Search efforts in remote waters off Australia's west coast are still underway. In July, Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine while carrying 298 passengers and crew. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
This is Africa News Tonight. With Kim Lewis, I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Al-Shabaab militants attack a military base on the outskirts of the town of Baidoa, killing at least six Somali soldiers. Kenya's high court suspends some of the more controversial measures of a national security law. And Gambian security forces begin house-to-house searches in the capital after a failed attempt to get rid of the president. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, the elephant population of Mozambique is under siege. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with Nations Cup football.
Kim, we're going to talk some Nations Cup football with our African football guru, David Legg. Happy New Year, David.
Thank you, Sunny, and best wishes to all our listeners from Cairo to Cape Town, from Madagascar to the Cape Verde Islands, all over the continent.
David, as we look forward to 2015, the 30th edition of the Africa Cup of Nations, just around the corner in Equatorial Guinea. It kicks off on January 17th. And I know you mentioned it on a previous show, David, but this really is shaping up as one of the most competitive Nations Cups in recent years. Your thoughts?
Yes, Sunny, I'm quite prepared to stick my neck out. I was actually talking today to Andre Aronsa. He was the goalkeeper in the South African 1996 Cup of Nations winning squad. And we were almost in total agreement. I had seven potential winners of the competition, and he had six. And his six were also included in my seven. I'm feeling particularly brave, Sonny, so I'm going to stick my neck out. I'm going to go through this group by group. And what I would like you to do, Sonny, if the form goes haywire, you must please destroy the table so it cannot be held in evidence against me. Sonny, if we look, first of all, at Group A, that's very much a Central African group. You've got Equatorial Guinea, the host nation, Congo-Brazzaville. You've also got Gabon, and you've also got Burkina Faso. Now, I'm going to be very bold and say that I don't see any of those four countries as potential champions, and Andre Aronsa happened to back me up on that one. Gabon could be one to watch, Sonny. They've got in Aubameyang, a very good striker, and a crucial thing, which we both sort of agreed on in our chat today, was it the conditions. For example, the North African teams, Algeria and Tunisia, may battle a bit to adapt to the conditions of Central Africa. But that said, I'm writing off Group A in the sense I don't see a potential winner of the competition coming from there. If we move on to Group B, that's Tunisia, Zambia, DR Congo, and the Cape Verde Islands, I am going to say Tunisia are potential winners because they were very impressive in the qualifying competition. And, for example, they went to Egypt and won 1-0 in Cairo. And Egypt may not be as strong as they have been in the past, but nevertheless, very few countries go to Cairo and win, even in the days when the Pharaohs are struggling a bit. So I'm putting them down, Sonny, as the first of my potential champions. I know Zambia won in Central Africa in 2012, but I just don't see them repeating that feat. DR Congo, potential quarterfinalists, same with Cape Verde, but certainly not potential champions. So far, Tunisia I'm marking down as my potential champions. In Group C, I feel, Sonny, all four countries are potential champions. That's Senegal, South Africa, Ghana, and Algeria. Andre Aronson disagreed with me in that he feels that the club form shown by the Senegalese, particularly in the English Premier League, is not replicated when it comes to the national team, so he didn't see them as potential champions. Algeria are number one in Africa. I think the key with them, Sonny, is can they adapt to the conditions? They've certainly got the footballers capable of winning the competition, but how are they going to cope with the conditions in Equatorial Guinea? That is the big question mark. The South Africans, finishing top of a group, which included Nigeria, that's sort of a dream beyond their wildest imagination just a few months ago. But now comes the real test. They passed the qualifying hurdle. Now let's see how they cope against the really big guns. They're going to miss Muyiwa, there's no doubt about that. And the original first choice that he replaced, Tumelin Kune, he's injured and is unlikely to travel to Equatorial Guinea. And also, Sonny, one or two questions about the South African defence. But nevertheless, given the fact that they've done so well, I think you cannot dismiss their chances. Ghana, too, looking at my record, Sonny, in the last four tournaments, they finished third, second, fourth, and fourth. Now, that's a team that's sort of been knocking on the door for so long now, and they've got the likes of the Ayew brothers, they've got Asamoah, Guyan. So you've got to say that they are potential champions. Where I disagree with Andre Arantza is Senegal. When you look at the list of strikers they've got, let's take, for example, Mame Diouf. He scored twice for Stoke at the weekend in England. Papiss Cissé, he scored for Newcastle at the weekend. And then you've got Sadio Mane, who scored for Southampton against Chelsea. They've got an absolute embarrassment of riches. And I think, Sonny, the key question with Senegal is can that good club form be translated into the national team? They've also got a very good coach in Alain Giresse, the former France star. So I'm adding all of those four countries to Tunisia as potential champions. Then we move on to Group D, which is Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Mali, and Guinea. And I believe the two countries who stand up here are Cameroon and Ivory Coast. Let's look at Cameroon first, a disastrous World Cup, but they've bounced back really well. Eto'o's retirement, in my opinion, was a blessing in disguise because I think he was causing more trouble than he was worth. And also another troublesome character, Alex Song, he was dropped from the national squad. Full credit to Volker Fink, the German coach. He's really stuck his neck out. And he's also stuck with Cameroon. I think after the shenanigans of Brazil at the World Cup, many people would have said he would have fled back to Germany. But he's stuck with the Indomitable Lions. And they'll definitely be contenders. I mean, any side that can take the Ivory Coast apart in Yaoundé by 4-1 have got to be considered. And then, Sonny, last but not least, the Ivory Coast. In an interesting situation now, because for the first time since 2006, they're not going to be the title favourite. So some of the pressure is off them.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
They also won't have Didier Drogba. And there are certainly question marks about them, particularly that 4-1 hiding in Cameroon and also the 4-3 defeat at home by the Democratic Republic of Congo. So they don't look as strong as they have been in the past, but football is a very funny game. And it may well be that perhaps a weaker Ivory Coast team on paper may well prove a stronger threat. I think the fact that they're no longer the favourite, Sonny, is going to be a big plus for them. So, sticking my neck out, I believe the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations winners will come from the following seven countries. It will be either Tunisia, Ghana, South Africa, Algeria, or Senegal, Cameroon, or Ivory Coast. And dark horses, Sonny, keep an eye out for the Cape Verde Islands. They won't win the competition, but I think they could upset a few people before they're eliminated themselves.
Finally, David, as we look forward to another exciting year in African football, can we also look forward to a few of your very challenging African football quiz questions?
Oh, yes, Sonny, I'm working hard on it. I think we'll maybe bring in the new year next week with one. I'm determined to stump everybody from Cairo to Cape Town, from Antananarivo to Pry over there in the Cape Verde Islands. My philosophy, Sonny, for 2015 is that no one is going to get these correct answers. Obviously, with the Nations Cup almost upon us, as you said, just a couple of weeks to go now. The questions will, of course, be based on the Cup of Nations. So for all those Sunnyside of Sport listeners who love taking part in these quiz competitions, you better hone up on your Africa Cup of Nations knowledge.
We look forward to those quiz questions, David.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
The voice of America.
B-O-A. Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the voice of America. President Obama is a big sports fan, and I'm guessing he might have watched on television a bit of the 7th annual Winter Classic at Nationals Park, located about 1 mile from our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. Nationals Park is home to the Washington Nationals Major League Baseball Club, but on New Year's Day, Nationals Park was transformed into a big outdoor ice hockey rink. The Washington Capitals hosted the 5-time Stanley Cup champion Chicago Blackhawks in the ice hockey contest. More than 42,000 fans packed the park for the one-off outdoor game, which is said to net millions of dollars in ticket sales, television advertising, and memorabilia for the National Hockey League. And for the record, if you're keeping score, the hometown favorites, the Capitals, won the game 3-2, and they won it in thrilling fashion. The tie-breaking goal came with about 12 seconds left in the Winter Classic. The goal was scored by Troy Brower, who used to play for the Blackhawks. Follow the Sunnyside of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments at my Facebook page. And my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the elephant population of Mozambique is under siege. And next, using hair to help trace cultural roots. But first, some music. Here is RJ of Sierra Leone with Change the World.
RJ. What's going on? The world. Cold. Ooh, yeah. It's up to you and me. Ooh, yeah. Make that change that the world badly needs. Yeah. What's going on in the world? The world. It's getting so cold. It's getting so cold. Little children's crying out. Crying out. Living in the midst of war and hunger. And hunger, if you only search hard, oh yeah, and soon you will find that it's not that so hard,
not that so hard.
To love you, my brother, to tell you I care, to treat you the to tell me the reason for all the hate, all the hate. You are my brother, can't you see?
You see?
No more inequality, we all the same.
No more.
If you believe, we can break the world of visions in our lives. We can make this world,
make this world.
And lust becomes the order of the day. Constantly confused and losing the real meaning of life. People preaching equality, but I ain't seen no practice. All I see is the world's getting cold. The prophecy and lies all the time on the news. But now you want to class and you race me. No respect for human lives, no peace to this. And war, number one priority. Treating others like beasts in the name of terrorism. So you gotta check yourself before you start judging others. Cause the guns cannot change it, the hate cannot change it. The only thing that can change this world.
Sierra Leone's RJ would change the world.
Well, the elephant population of Mozambique is under siege, conservationists say, after dozens of killings in recent weeks. The government has put together a task force to address the spate of poaching in the country's northern elephant reserve, where officials estimate that two elephants are being killed each day. From VOA's Southern Africa Bureau in Johannesburg, Anita Powell asked, what is driving the slaughter of these gentle giants?
Elephants are being killed at alarming rates in northern Mozambique, conservationists say, warning that anti-poaching measures must be stepped up. Most of the carnage is taking place inside the Nyasa National Reserve, a conservation area approximately the size of the nation of Denmark and twice the size of South Africa's famous Kruger National Park. The reserve is home to approximately 12,000 elephants. Last month, a gang of poachers suspected of killing 39 elephants this year was arrested, and the World Conservation Society counted 22 slaughtered elephants in the first 2 weeks of September alone. The United Nations estimates poaching and ivory trafficking are at a 25-year high, with 170 tons of ivory traded in the past 5 years. Ivory demand has skyrocketed in Asia, along with the price. World Wildlife Fund African Elephant Coordinator Lamine Sanogo spoke to VOA News from Nairobi.
This is a real concern, and the rate is increasing every day. And we think that if there is no solution, immediate solution, elephant population is going to collapse seriously when you look at the poaching rate currently.
He says he is especially concerned that the poachers, many of whom he says are part of international crime syndicates and have sophisticated tools, outnumber and outclass the relatively small number of park rangers protecting Nyasa's elephants.
This region of northern Mozambique is very critical for the conservation of the African elephant. And we really need much more partners, including government and the international community, to join the effort to address the issue before it becomes late.
Mozambique is still recovering from a long civil war that ended 2 decades ago. Last year, the top rebel group turned opposition party threatened to again turn rebellious. Those worries have since abated with the recent peace deal, but Sanogo says conservationists are worried about possible unrest during and after next week's national elections.
If it is a peaceful election, we don't think that it is going to be a problem. But as you might know, the political instability make more vulnerable conservation of species. When there is a political troubles and no one wants to go on the field, so the protected area are much more open for any illegal actions.
He says with their numbers rapidly dwindling, elephants cannot afford to be caught in the middle. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
At a recent exhibition at White Space Gallery in Ikoyi, Lagos, a young artist used her hair to help trace her cultural roots. From Lagos, Jennifer Ndiamen reports.
So Tayi Daho wanted to explore the themes of culture, memory, and reincarnation. What better way to uncover her own identity and her family's history than using something very personal? The answer, which was on the top of her head, became the title of her project, which she called Evolution.
I got it from the words evolution to evolve, and the idea of hair being my point of departure from the beginning of the project. The project really isn't about hair. Hair just happens to be the starting point of where the project started from, and somehow it led me to thinking about memory and what are the characters, what are the things that make up memory, you know, and how we as people should, you know, value the memories that we have and we make, and the ones that, especially our parents, because this project was also a lot of it was based on the memory of my dad and my mom.
Idao's hair is long and wavy, while many Nigerians is short and kinky. People often ask her about the difference, so her hair's genealogy became part of the exhibit. Taye explored her family's origin and the idea that she perhaps received a dominant gene from her paternal grandmother, Aye, who is said to have been Caucasian. Taye never met Aye. She questioned her parents for clues and answers to help her form what has now become her first solo exhibition, a collection of self-portraits on tracing paper, which she titled Shortcuts. It includes a sculpture of a face tagged Odowa, which exaggerated long hair made from newsprint. By showing her face with long hair in repetitive form, Taye effectively intertwined her identity with that of her grandmother, Aye, who also had long hair. She grew up hearing her father say she is the reincarnation of his mother. In the course of creating the year-long project, Taye was confronted with fragility of memory itself. She compares it to Africa's own forgotten or disappearing culture, as people embrace modernity and its emphasis on the present, not the past. She says the exhibition is her own way of preserving memory. The Lagos-based painter, Kelani Abaz, attended the exhibition.
I'm really impressed about the works on the walls. They are quite strong. And they are very strong in terms of materials and mediums of material. And again, the theme that the artist works about, the theme of the artist, they are not the usual themes that you see in art, especially in Nigeria. So they are quite unique. I love what I'm saying.
An environmentalist and art enthusiast, Mrs. Kofo Adeleke, says Taye's work will have wide appeal.
And I think the message is very, very important, you know, in terms of her sort of using this to address identity issues. And I think it's a subject that's been around, but I don't think it's a subject that in Nigeria people have really been addressing. And so I think that this is going to have a much, much wider audience in Nigeria and outside Nigeria. So I think that what she's starting to do is really going to be very, very interesting. And I love her honesty and I love her bravery.
White Space Gallery, where the exhibition was held, is a privately funded creative space that supports young artists like Taye to promote their work. The artist says she hopes to continue the Evolution project next year. Jennifer Ederman reporting for VOA, Lagos, Nigeria.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pledging to end the political infighting that threatened to paralyze the Somali government and distract officials from the important work of unifying the country under a federal framework, Omar Abdelrashid Ali Sharma Arke has been named Prime Minister of Somalia. Appointed by Parliament on December 24th, he becomes the East African nation's third premier in just over a year, following the removal of former Prime Minister Abdoulaye Sheikh Ahmed in November due to a no-confidence vote by Parliament. The earlier removal of Ahmed's predecessor, Abdi Farah Shirdon, after a political dispute with President Hassan Sheikh, disappointed the government's international supporters and distracted from efforts to combat the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Sharma Arke, who served previously as Prime Minister in the transitional federal government in 2009-2010, pledged on taking office to name an all-inclusive cabinet of ministers and address disputes through consultation and discussion. The United States welcomes the parliamentary confirmation of Prime Minister Sharma Arke. We look forward to the Prime Minister assuming office and to his prompt appointment of a capable Council of Ministers. We urge the President, Prime Minister, Parliament, and Council of Ministers to make progress toward realizing goals of critical importance to the nation, such as constitutional review, state formation, election preparations, development of military and police forces, and public financial management reforms. The United States remains committed to supporting the Somali government and people as they stabilize and rebuild their nation, and we look forward to strengthening our important partnership with Somalia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.